Support for WPR comes from Doulaying the Doula, offering birth and postpartum training and certification programs for medical professionals and other interested humans. More information about training is at doulaworkshop.com. Support for WPR comes from Luther College in Decorah, Iowa. Academic scholarships are automatically offered to eligible students upon admission, and all Luther students receive some form of financial aid. Luther.edu.
Well, here we are with another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Great to have you with us today, and great to have Patty Nagai with us as always. You know, the end of the growing season can seem a little sad, and it can be hard to get too excited about doing that fall garden cleanup. But folks like Patty, who is the UW Extension horticulture educator for Racine County, she has lots of great advice to share for what we can do this fall to make next spring a little more fun, and especially right at the start when we're aching for a little color and a little greenery. So Patty, thanks for coming by.
You are welcome. I'm always happy to be on.
Well, we have lots to talk about, and of course we hope that our listeners will join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post a question, comment, or a garden photo on our Facebook page. We always love to see those. That's The Larry Mealer Show, and Mealer is spelled M-E-I-L-L-E-R, which is not always the first guess that people have. So like to help them find that, because there's always great information there. Well, one of the things I was really excited to talk about, because I think I'm going to try it for the first time this year, is planting garlic. And I'm a huge garlic fan, raw, cooked, pretty much anyway, but I've never planted it. And so, Patty, this is the time, right, to plant garlic?
This is the time. So when you're thinking about planting tulips and daffodils, it's also time to plant garlic.
All right.
And garlic, you know, is an amazing crop. It's very easy to grow. It's very easy to plant. In our part of Wisconsin, the southeastern corner, we tend to have really high pH soils, and garlic does great and high in you know, the higher pHs, so it does really well there. It prefers a real rich organic soil though. So if you're growing in raised beds or you know, very heavily amended soils with compost, it grows really well. But it's one of those things that you put it in the ground in the fall and you're gardening and it feels good and you have lovely weather to do that in, and then you pretty much forget about it until next spring.
Well,
you do need to do a little bit.
I was going to say, you know exactly what to do for making things grow, but there are some of us that need a little more information. So you said it likes rich organic soil, but let's go back to the pH for a second. So if we have soil that's on the lower end of the pH, is there something, and are there parts of the state that tend to be lower?
There are some sections that have a little bit of the lower pH, and it's always a good idea when you're going to grow something new that you haven't tried before, if you have a good handle on what your soil is like, it will help you make good decisions about the type that you're going to grow and the you know, the particular cultivars and everything, and whether or not you do need to make any soil amendments. It will grow in a pretty broad range of pH, but some things don't like high pH, so I'm always really happy when I find something that will grow really well at a higher pH. But it'll grow really well. Now, if you're growing in a pH of, let's say, cranberry bog pH of 4 or something like that, it would have issues with that, and you would have to lime it in order to bring the pH up to get some satisfactory
garlic. But if our soil's kind of in
the middle, you're in the neutral range, if you're in slightly acidic to slightly alkaline, it grows very well. It does like a well-drained soil. It still is going to need full sun.
Okay.
And the thing that you have to remember about garlic is that you're planting it now, you know, when you're not planting a whole lot of other things in your vegetable garden. But it takes a long time to develop a really good-sized garlic bulb. So that space in your garden is going to be garlic until mid-July.
Okay. So that was actually skipping ahead. That was one of my questions.
Right.
When we're putting them in, say, early, is it early to mid-October?
It depends on what part of the state you're in. You need to plant it, of course, before the ground freezes.
Right.
And that's what we say about daffodils and tulips as well. You know, you need to get them in the ground before the ground freezes, obviously.
So this garlic,
you don't want to plant too soon, though, because if you plant those type of fall bulbs too early, they will start to grow top growth, and that's not what you want. You want to be able to allow them time to grow roots, but not spend so much energy producing any kind of foliage. Now, you will get some small slips of leaves coming out of mm-hmm. the garlic in the fall if you plant it. Even now, you will still see a little bit of green growth, and that's not a problem. But you don't want a full-blown green growth. So you want to make sure that it's cool enough and the days are short enough that you're not going to get a lot of top growth. But garlic roots will continue to grow well into the late fall and winter. Hmm. And depending on your soil, they could get 3 to 5 feet deep.
Wow.
So you would never suspect that when you dig it.
Wow.
Or when you buy it in the grocery store at the farmer's market and you see
even at the farmer's market where there's a little more root usually.
Well, yeah, but they cut those roots off.
So let's go back to the basics on planting the garlic. So we would put them in before the ground freezes in the fall, but you're saying not harvest them until mid-July.
Right.
Okay.
To get a really good crop, for most of the cultivars, it takes about 9 months.
Wow.
It's just like having a baby.
And that's a lot longer than a lot of vegetables, so something to keep in mind, like you said, with the space. And what kind of depth are we talking about?
Well, again, that depends a little bit on the type of garlic that you're planting. And so, like, with any other bulb, you're only planting the clove. Of course, you're not planting the whole bulb. You're going to plant a single clove.
So basically, for every clove in a head of garlic, you're going to get a whole nother head.
Right. But you want to plant it, 3 to 4 inches deep. And then once the ground freezes, if you think about it, you might want to go out and put some winter mulch on top. Just to keep the ground from frost heaving and upending your little garlic cloves that are making their way in the world.
And which end is up?
Well, when you look at the clove, there is a pointy end and a more blunt end. Mm-hmm. And the blunt end is where the roots will emerge. If you've ever had a garlic bulb in your cabinet that has started to send out shoots, you know that the pointy end, you'll start to see a little green tip. And of course, that's the shoot end. So ideally, you would like that to point upwards. But plants are very clever, and they will figure out which end is up, and they will right themselves and do what they need to do in order to grow correctly, because they understand where the earth is and where gravity is and where the sun is going to shine. So they make their way.
We're talking with Patty Nagai. She is UW Extension horticulture educator for Racine County. Right now, talking about planting garlic, but we will certainly be moving on to other things like fall bulbs, fall garden cleanup, and things to leave in the garden for some interesting winter landscape. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234 or send us an email at talk@wpr.org. Now, what about spacing? How much room does each little clove need to turn into a head?
I think the recommended spacing for most of the cultivars is somewhere between 4 and 6 inches apart. You can space them, of course, farther apart than that and still get good development. But if you're doing, especially if you're doing intensive gardening kind of techniques, I believe on square foot gardening, they have them as close as 2 inches apart, which is a little close. But if you have a really rich soil, a really rich, well-drained organic soil, you probably could get away with that. But if the thing about plants that develop an underground storage root, bulb, whatever, whether it's beets or carrots or garlic, if you space them too closely, you may not get that development that you are seeking. And so you need to make sure that you've left enough room for the plants to fully develop. So I would definitely not go any closer than 2 inches, but probably four to six for most cultivars is going to be a really good spacing.
Now, you said, stick them in the ground, basically forget it. But is it really that easy? Should we keep watering it until the ground freezes? Or is there any fertilizer that we should be giving it?
If you have, it depends on whether or not you've had your soil test done. Judith, you're asking such complicated questions. No, everybody's soil is different. And depending on what you've had in that part of the vegetable garden previously, you may not need to fertilize at all, or you may need to add a nitrogen supplement in order to get good development. Mm-hmm. If you've been enriching your soil on a regular basis with good quality compost, You may have plenty of nutrients in the soil and not need anything. At the bare minimum, though, for a lot of vegetable gardens, nitrogen is an essential element that needs to be added on a regular basis. But a lot of people will get that nitrogen through the addition of a compost type mm-hmm. of material. So you may not need anything at all. Water is always important. And fall is a great time to plant a lot of things. It's a good time to move a lot of perennials and to plant woody shrubs and trees. And with anything that you're planting in the fall, water is essential. Water is always essential. And the nice thing about fall, however, is that we typically get really good rainfalls. Mm-hmm. You know, you may not need to water because the Mother Nature may take care of that for
and
you.
And overall, it's a little cooler, so
right. And so they're not using as much. You don't want the water. You don't want any garden area to be saturated, but you do want things to stay moist. And it's really important for anything that maintains its foliage over the winter, evergreens of any kind. That they go into winter moist. And so if we're not getting regular rainfalls, yes, you need to continue to water your garden areas until the ground freezes. Otherwise, you may end up with a significant amount of mm-hmm. winter damage and mm-hmm. sometimes fatal winter damage.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Since I know we've gotten people very excited about planting garlic, I want to make sure they know where to get it. So do we go to a garden center to get garlic bulbs? Can we use garlic bulbs that we're buying that we would normally buy to eat?
A lot of places that you can get garlic. I would not recommend planting garlic from the grocery store.
Because you just don't know how
it was treated. Most likely as a cultivar that was great for California, might not be the best cultivar for us. In our area, we have a number of seed and feed kind of farm stores that sell garlic. You can find it at several of the garden centers around our area carry garlic, and you might be able to find it there. You can you could purchase it from a farmer at the farmer's market who grows garlic, and that way you're assured that it's a locally grown cultivar that'll do well in
your
own area.
And you can ask questions.
And you can ask questions about the different cultivars. Many of the farmers who grow garlic will grow several different cultivars, and a lot of them will be heirloom-type garlics. You might see soft-neck types or hard-neck types. You might have the pink ones. You might have the elephant-style mm-hmm. garlics that are very large but low in flavor, mm-hmm. I think.
Yeah.
You know, and they all have different flavors. Some of them are incredibly pungent and some of them are very mild. So you know, it would be nice if you could try a lot of different garlics and decide which one you like the mm-hmm. best. I'm a big believer in planting things in your vegetable garden that you actually will eat, as opposed to just planting them because it looked pretty in the mm-hmm. catalog.
Or because you know it'll grow well.
Because you know it'll grow well.
A lot of things you're not going to eat.
You know, I can grow kale in my garden all day long and probably 10 months out of the year, but that doesn't mean my children are still, they're not going to eat it unless I hide it in things.
Well, and with the garlic, it's interesting. I did talk to one of the farmers at my local farmer's market who sells several varieties of really interesting garlics. And when I told him that I was looking for heads that I was going to plant the cloves mm-hmm. from, he went through and found ones that had more small cloves because
you'll get more.
So
absolutely.
So, you know, the farmers are more than happy to help and share their knowledge.
And we planted garlic in our teaching garden, our community garden in Racine last year. And that's where the starter garlic came from, or at least some of it, but probably about half of it came from a local farmer who had already selected different cultivars that did really well in our environment.
We are talking with Patty Nagai. She is the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Racine County on this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We will be back in just a moment. Right now, we're talking with Patty Nagai about fall gardening. And so we talked a lot about garlic, Patty. Let's move on to those bulbs that we can plant in the fall so that when we're really desperate for signs of spring, there they are. What are some great really early flowers for the spring?
There are so many different bulbs we can plant now. And, you know, we typically think daffodils and tulips, which is fabulous. I love them all, actually. Tulips tend to be a little bit a little bit later, although there's a range of times in which they bloom, but they tend to be a little bit later. And tulips are not as long lived in the environment as some of the other bulbs. They don't naturalize, for example, like the daffodils do. There are species tulips, however, that are smaller and do quite well in rock gardens and small beds. One of my favorites for early bloom is actually the dwarf iris, the iris reticulata. Very easy to plant, and it makes you feel like you've really accomplished something because you could probably plant 200 of them in 20 minutes and think, wow, I just planted 200 flowers. And they are very good to come up and to bloom, and they bloom so early. I have many photos of my iris blooming in the snow. And they look different than the crocus. Of course, crocus are a great standby for that as well.
Right.
But the dwarf iris are fabulous, and they just add a really nice little wake up in the spring to your garden.
Are they mainly purple, or do they come in other colors as well?
They come in various shades of purple and blue, but they're against the snow, there is nothing more beautiful than that dark green strappy foliage and those little purple flowers. And so it's a nice little thing for the spring.
Hyacinths are so nice for the scent.
Yes. And so for some people, they're a little overwhelming. You know, they can trigger all sorts of lovely allergies in some people, but they are pretty easy to grow too. And I have found that hyacinths tend to be much longer lived in my yard anyway than tulips are. They tend to last a very long time. And so they continue to come back. The best, you know, for naturalizing, of course, are things like the squills, you know, the scillas, and the daffodils. And there are so many different daffodils to choose from, all different shapes and sizes and colors. They come in a whole range of styles now. And they do so well in the garden and naturalize in a big way. You know, once you plant daffodils, typically you will have daffodils for a long time unless you have a flooding issue or something that's causing the bulbs to rot out. Mm-hmm. But daffodils are also better if you have wildlife, because most of the time they won't bother the daffodils, whereas tulips are apparently quite tasty, and lots of things like to eat tulips.
I planted a bunch of bulbs last fall for the first time, and it was so frustrating every morning to come out and see that squirrels or whatever had dug up so many. They were just strewn all over the lawn.
Yes.
Is there anything we can do?
Well, there are a lot of ways that you can protect your bulbs from digging. And, you know, the caging method, of course, which is very labor intensive, where you actually plant your bulbs in a cage. You know, it would have to be an incredibly valuable bulb for me to go to that extreme to do that. An easier method is to put down a layer of just a one thin sheet of chicken wire underneath your mulch, so that you don't really see it, but the squirrels certainly feel it, and they'll stop digging. So,
or maybe if we have floating row covers that we've taken off of.
Well, you could do that. You could cover with floating row cover, but then you've got that lovely white sheet in your yard. Yeah, people might wonder what you're doing.
Although desperation can drive you to
interesting things.
Oh,
yes, yes. I've had people trying to protect their roses from Japanese beetles, and they're covering the blossoms with floating row cover. Like, well, that must look really pretty in your yard. But it's protecting them, yes.
Now, bulbs, are there some bulbs that we should actually be taking out of the ground right now to overwinter?
Yes, and that would be a fabulous thing to remember to do, because I will tell you, this is my gardener's secret here, is that I'm actually kind of lazy in the fall when it comes to things like that, and I often forget to do it. And then my cannas and dahlias become compost because, you know, all of a sudden the ground is frozen. I'm like, how did that happen? But yes, if you're growing cannas or dahlias or any of those types of bulbs, banana, taro, the elephant ears, any of those.
Are gladiolas also?
Gladiolas as well. Okay. This would be the time to start preparing to do that. But you really want to keep them in the ground as long as possible. So if the plants are still actively growing and green or red-leaved or whatever, as the case may be, you don't need to dig them just yet. But it would be a good idea to dig them before a hard freeze. And not because, you know, that's not going to freeze the ground. The ground will stay fairly warm for a long time. But what happens when you have a really hard freeze is that it kills the tissue off. And if that that tissue starts to rot, it can actually move down into your bulbs, your corms, your tubers, whatever the storage mechanism is for that particular plant. And then you're going to end up with a rot inside the storage organ that you're trying to save. So you do want to try and dig them before a hard freeze. A light frost is okay for most of them, but that might be a good reminder to go out there and take care of them.
And so we're basically trying to strike a balance. We want to leave them in the ground as long as possible because they're storing up energy, right, to make it through the winter and then to reemerge in the spring.
Right.
But we don't want to leave them in so long that they get damaged. So it's
finding
that perfect weekend.
Right. And if on that perfect weekend you're away somewhere doing a talk and then you realize that you've come home to frozen plants, then it's too late.
It sounds like it was not a hypothetical situation, but we won't ask you to go into detail. Well, you can join the conversation with Patty Nagai, UW Extension horticulture educator for Racine County, by calling 1-800-642-1234. And we do have Lewis in Manitowish Waters on the line, so let's go there. Hi, Lewis. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, good.
Okay, I have a question. I have tried planting winter onions. I live in northern Wisconsin, Manitowish Waters, and they do come up, but after a couple of years, they die off. Is it my soil, or am I planting them wrong, or what?
Well, I have never grown winter onions, and I'm not sure if it would be your soil or if it is something to do just with the environment. Are they frost heaving? Are they pushing up out of the soil, or are they actually dying?
They actually die after a while.
So you have to continually replant?
Right. And do you know what a winter onion is? They call them multiplier onions also.
I do know what you're talking about, but I have not grown them. And so So I'm not sure if that's a typical thing, if they have to be replanted. My understanding was that they sort of replant themselves and they just continue to spread.
Right. They spread.
Right. So I don't know. You know, it would be worthwhile to perhaps try them in a different part of your garden. It would not be a bad idea if you haven't done a soil test to check the organic matter and at least the pH of your soil. I would ask about the drainage. I mean, is it a part of your garden where you have a potential drainage problem? Is it a low area where you might get a large amount of snow accumulation, ice, or melted snow where you're getting a lot of water and soil saturation?
No, not really. It's very well drained. It's pretty sandy soil, and it does have a fair amount of snow in the wintertime, but the ground does not freeze real solid because the amount of snow on top of the ground.
Right, right. So the ground is, but you said it was also sandier. So then let's go the other route. Is it a potential that they're experiencing some kind of drought?
It could be. I'm just looking for answers. I'm just wondering if I should put more mulch or plant them in potting soil, you know, dig out the existing soil and put potting soil in there.
One of the things that you might want to try is amending your soil with a pretty stout amount of good quality compost. You know, if your soil is really that sandy, it could be a drought and a nutrition issue because sandy soils, of course, don't hold the moisture as well.
So the water is just
going
right through.
And they also tend to be a little bit depleted of a lot of the nutrients, especially nitrogen. And onions, you know, onions like a richer soil. They like, you know, a lot of organic matter, and they appreciate a healthy dose of nitrogen in there. So perhaps you could amend your soil. You know, start in a new area of your garden, amend it with a lot of good quality, clean compost, and try again. The mulching is a great idea. If your soil's not actually freezing, though, usually for winter mulching, we recommend that the soil be frozen before you apply it. But in your case, you're getting this heavy layer of snow which in essence is acting like a winter mulch. So I'm not sure that mulching is really the answer, but I think amending your soil with compost and getting some good organic matter in there would be a great starting point.
Well, and Lewis, I'm going to suggest that you keep listening because coming up right now, Jill in Rhinelander says she has grown multiplier onions for quite a few years, and I'm guessing that she has some suggestions.
Excellent.
So let's go to Jill in Rhinelander. Hi, Jill.
Hi. I'm just calling to say I have multiplier onions I got from my father-in-law in Eau Claire many, many years ago. We've had them in the garden for over 20 years. Wow. I've moved them once. We have very sandy soil. Mm-hmm. I don't put a lot of compost or extra nutrients or anything. I just make sure that some of the multiplier bulbs that form get planted. They'll
okay.
self-seed, but I make sure, and I have onions enough for us and to give away and everything. I mean,
so you're going the extra step, though, to actually plant the little bulblets that form on top. You're actually
just to make sure that they get covered with a little soil.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't start a new plot or anything. The only time I dug them up this spring because there was so much grass and quackgrass mm-hmm. and stuff in them, and I replanted them right away.
Okay.
And, I mean, I've got the new little bulblets that were there. They're
mm-hmm.
already sending up shoots.
Wow.
I mean, I don't do anything special. I don't put any special fertilizer on.
Nice.
I mean, I just kind of plant them and leave them.
Jill, I think Patty's kind of jealous.
I am jealous, and I'm thinking that you need to share some of those little bulblets. And perhaps Lewis could benefit from your particular strain of multiplier onion.
That seemed to do well in sandy northern soil.
That seems to do well there, yeah. So that's fabulous. That's good to know. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks,
bye.
Jill. It's always so nice when our listeners help each other out, isn't it?
It is. And I always learn something new every day. That's my goal. It's one of the reasons I love gardening and horticulture, though, because there is so much to learn.
And
I learn things from my Master Gardener volunteers all the time.
Well, and Kyle, going back to the garlic, said, Kyle on Facebook said, I've let my garlic go to seed and have planted the small bulblets with some success. Should I be planting the full cloves instead?
You can plant garlic from seed, of course. That is the purpose of seed, to produce new plants. But it will take you several years to get the size that you would get in a single season from a clove.
Okay.
So we talk about garlic seed all the mm-hmm. time, and they refer to it that way. If you go online or in the catalog, mm-hmm. they'll talk about garlic seed. But it's not really seed that they're selling you. It's the individual cloves. They just call it that.
Because he's saying, maybe the terminology isn't exactly right, but he's saying that the little bulblets that come up on the top of the, is it the scape?
Yes,
okay.
And you can plant those as well.
And is that a next year thing, or does that take a little longer?
It depends on
okay.
how big they are.
Okay.
And I think there is a cultivar difference with that as well. But I believe he's referring to the real seed
okay.
that's formed from the flower. And
okay.
yes, you can grow garlic from seed, but it will take you several years to get a full-size bulb.
So seed takes a long time. Bulblets take a little less time. A clove from a fully developed head is probably the quickest route.
Now, right. with the smaller the clove, you're probably going to get a smaller bulb. And so it just depends on your environmental conditions, the cultivar, and when you get it in the ground.
Yes. All right. Since we're on Facebook, Chris had a question taking us in the flower direction. I have some surprise lilies planted in my lawn. Those are the ones that are green in the spring and bloom in August. Sometimes they flower, sometimes not. Should they be fertilized?
Oh, these are the ones that send the foliage up first, and then they come up later and send their beautiful blooms up. Everything in the lawn or in your flower bed or your vegetable bed will benefit from some fertilizer, depending on what is in your soil. And, you know, across the state of Wisconsin, we have so mm-hmm. many different types of soil with so many different nutrient levels. And even in a particular yard, you will find that, you know, your front yard may be very different from your backyard as far as nutrient levels. But in general, what plants need that is somewhat ephemeral in nature in the soil is nitrogen, mm-hmm. because nitrogen changes forms so readily. And nitrogen is used in such high quantities that it's always kind of a starting point for fertilization. But if they're doing well, if they're growing well, I think he said they bloom sometimes and sometimes they don't, that might be a nutrient issue. It might be a water issue. You know, there are a lot of different things that can affect flowering.
Well, and if it sounds like they're naturalized in the lawn, mm-hmm. so they're also competing with
the
turf
grass or tree roots, yeah. possibly, if they're in there. If you are fertilizing your lawn, even if you're doing it just once a year, that is probably sufficient for the lilies as well.
All right. Thanks for that question, Chris. And let's mention that on the Facebook page, our friends over at the UW Extension Learning Store posted and said, Patty's right about the importance of knowing your soil's fertility. And they offer a link to a PDF file that walks you through the soil testing process. So thank you so much for that. That'll be really useful for a lot of folks.
I love it when we all link together that way.
Well,
it's
and the Learning Store,
thing.
We talk about the Learning Store so often, but there are so many amazing resources there. So it's the UW Extension Learning Store brochures, booklets right. on all kinds of things, often also in Spanish, sometimes mm-hmm. even in Hmong. So
right.
it's an amazing.
And we have a lot of new publications that have come out recently. There's an entire series on composting and all the different sorts of compost bins in addition to how to compost in mm-hmm. your yard. It's very fabulous. And we have our community garden series as well that is has some really wonderful information in it.
Great. Well, let's go back to the phones and Libby in Park Falls. Hi, Libby.
Hi. I have a question about foxgloves.
All right.
Well, I planted some either last summer or the summer before. I can't remember which. They were beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they died away in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
And then I didn't have them at all this summer until August. They started coming up at the back of my garden.
Oh.
So I just have the leaves there. They're beautiful, but just leaves. And I'm wondering if I should take those foxglove out and put them in little pots and try to overwinter them that way, or if I should just let them die back. Will they come back?
Now, are foxgloves biennial?
Yes, and I was trying to remember. It seems that there are some newer cultivars that are not biennial.
And biennial means every other year they flower, right?
Right, and so a true biennial, the first year they will come up as foliage only. The second year they will flower and then they will die. And so to get them to reproduce in your garden and act like perennials, you really rely on that seed production and the ability of your garden area to allow the seeds to germinate and grow without being treated with a seed germination inhibitor like you know, a preen kind of a product or corn gluten meal or something like that. Or you're weeding them out thinking that they are some undesirable species.
Mm-hmm.
and a lot of times that happens. So with foxglove, you know, they will die out once they flower, at least the traditional foxglove that is a true biennial. So it's possible that what has happened in your yard is that before your foxglove died, they set seed. And that seed got transferred to a slightly different area of your garden and it has germinated and grown. And if you leave them there, next year they will flower. I would not recommend bringing them into the house. Foxglove does not make such a great house plant. And if you just leave them there, they should be fine next year.
Well, that's good to know. I love them. And I hated to see them not come back.
So right. They're beautiful.
Here.
Right. And remember what those small plants look like. And then if you happen to see more of them coming up in your yard, then you will know that those are not weeds
mm-hmm.
and don't pull them.
And thanks for that call, Libby. Is foxglove also called digitalis? Is
right.
that the same?
Poisonous.
I was
yes.
going to say, so maybe that's that's one of the best reasons not to bring it into the house because
yeah,
you don't know
it's
who
very
might
poisonous.
Get into it.
Digitalis is... well, it's a heart regulator
right,
drug,
right, right.
So it can be quite deadly if taken in.
Great, thanks
large
for that
quantities.
Call, Libby, and hopefully you'll get wonderful flowers next
mm-hmm.
year. Marilyn in South Range is up next. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi. We recently moved raspberry plants to a raised bed, and it's about 10 inches off the ground, which
mm-hmm.
makes it easier to weed.
Mm-hmm.
I have a lot of weeds. I have a lot of leaves, and I was wondering if it would be a good idea to keep the weeds down and keep the soil good. if I should mulch the leaves and put it on top for the winter, or, you know, because it'll end up in the soil.
Actually, when you said you had weeds, if you were talking about my raspberry patch, that would have been completely accurate.
Completely accurate, yes. Yes, weeds and raspberries tend to go hand in hand. So whatever method that you can use to help keep those weeds down is a great idea. If you're going to use leaves as a mulch, leaves are great as a mulch. I would try to avoid things like black walnut. But leaves as a mulch are great, especially mixed species, so that you don't get one particular species that might cause you problems. But they do need to be mulched. And so chipped, mulched, cut up in some way, you don't want whole leaves, because whole leaves tend to mat down and maintain a little bit too much moisture between the layers of the leaves. And that creates a great environment for a number of different fungal organisms to grow. And so you just end up with a big slimy mess. It's a good idea to chip them or mulch them. You can run them over with a mulching lawnmower and try to create a finer grade of mulch. And that makes a great mulch for your raspberry bed. Sure.
Oak leaves from us, and I get some from my sister who lives in Superior, of different varieties.
Okay, sure.
It all mixes up together, so.
That's
and
a beautiful thing.
Keep the water in a little bit better too.
Mulch, you know, mulch is a wonderful tool to use in the garden. And if you can find a nice, clean, organic mulch to use that doesn't have weed seeds in it, that's even better. But mulch does help maintain moisture. It helps to reduce weed seeds, weeds from growing. And the mechanism behind that is basically by excluding light. And so the mulch layer needs to be thick enough that you're eliminating sunlight from hitting the surface of the soil. So if you don't have sunlight hitting the surface of the soil where those weed seeds are, you know, the weeds won't even germinate. And so that's the basis behind that. For winter mulches, if you're doing winter mulches, you know, they provide an even more interesting, I think, mechanism of maintenance in the garden, in that a winter mulch is applied after the ground is frozen, and it helps to keep the ground frozen. And the reason that's important is if you have anything that's newly planted, and it could be strawberries, it could be flowers, it could be garlic or tulips for that matter. If you get into a freeze-thaw cycle during the winter, where the ground has frozen and then it is thawing out again and then it freezes again, newly planted things tend to frost heave out of the soil, and that's deadly. You know, if you get roots exposed to winter temperatures and desiccation, that plant is going to die. And so winter mulch is equally important, especially for newly planted things in the garden.
Thanks for that call, Marilyn. And there's a lot more to cover with Patty Nagai about fall gardening. How was this year for your garden? What did particularly well, or what was kind of a disappointment? We'd love to hear from you. And Patty can offer her advice as well when you call 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We have some open lines and we'd love to hear from you. You can also send us an email at talk@wpr.org or post a question, comment, or a garden photo on our Facebook page. Robin Cherry, our on-air producer, is happy to take your calls. Stay tuned. We'll be back in just a moment. We are talking with Patty Nagai. She's UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Racine County here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. So glad you could join us today. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Larry Mueller. And Patty, you know, we often talk about fall garden cleanup, whether we actually get to it or not. first off, why is it important?
Well, it's important for a number of different reasons, and it depends on what you grow. But if, you know, when you're talking about the vegetable garden, of course, it's important to get out any of the plant refuse that's left over from the summer, especially if it's harboring any insects or diseases. And the same thing is true even for weeds that might be around your garden, not just in your garden, but around your garden. You know, disease spores and insects tend to overwinter in areas like that. So it's important to get them out of your garden and get things as ready for next year as possible. And depending on where you are and what you're gardening, there are a lot of different methods for doing that. In the perennial beds, there are some things that as soon as we get a freeze, they're just going to turn to mush. And they they tend to get kind of slimy. They can harbor all kinds of lovely little secondary disease organisms. You know, it can be just nasty.
So when we say get them out of the garden, so where hostas. Do we get them to?
So, for example, hostas. You know, when I see that we're going to be getting some really super cold weather, I will go in and start cutting my hostas back. And I don't feel like I have to do it all at once. I mean, it's something that is something I'm usually pretty good about doing. And it's also something I've trained my husband to do. So he knows he can cut those back.
Seems like your kids might be at almost an age to be able to train for that.
Yes, actually, what a great idea. I think they're ready this year to do that. And then things like that, I chop those up and put them in my compost pile. Certain diseases on tomatoes. I'm not real fond of putting my tomato vines into the compost because they tend to get all sorts of lovely little things on them. But most things I will chop up and put into the compost. Heavier wood materials, it's also a time that I start looking at trees and shrubs to see if I had any dieback, and later on I will cut those back. And we have a wood pickup in our neighborhood, so I stack those up and save them for the big pickup time. I'm not a big believer in burning, even though it is legal in my area. I don't think it's a healthy alternative in urban areas to be burning right. unnecessarily. So I don't do that. But a lot of people will do that with their plant refuse.
I have to say, one of the strong childhood memories I have is smelling burning leaves.
Yes, well, I have enough neighbors that do it, so I'm okay with that. Some of the perennials, it's really nice if you can leave them standing a little bit longer. The coneflowers, you know, produce so many seeds that the birds will continue to munch on into the fall, but eventually they're going to fall down as well.
Actually, mine usually are totally upright
really?
For the whole winter.
Well, it depends. So the purple coneflowers, and I have both natives and cultivars, they tend to hold up pretty well. Mm-hmm. But the yellow coneflowers, mm-hmm. I was just looking at them today and thinking, birds, you better hurry up because I'm cutting these babies down because they're like 6 feet tall.
Yeah. Oh, sure.
And they're starting to fall over. Ornamental grasses, I leave standing. I leave the grasses standing all winter. I leave the Baptisia standing. I do not cut that back.
What is Baptisia?
Baptisia is it's kind of a shrubby perennial. It's a native plant that makes a really beautiful blue and in some cases white flower in the spring, and then it makes pods that turn dark black.
Ooh.
So right now it's really pretty.
Sounds lovely.
It's a beautiful plant. So I leave that standing. But I do try to select the things that I know are going to look ugly as soon as it freezes. And I get those out while they're easier. It's much easier to cut them back when they're still standing as opposed to after they've frozen and are laying flat and slimy on the ground.
So you kind of alluded to it that for instance, birds will eat those seed heads mm-hmm. and things like that. But I'm guessing that the ornamental grasses and some of those other, like you said, shrubby, woody shrubs and things like that can provide some winter protection for our wildlife.
Absolutely. And, you know, some things also provide food and shelter. And so I don't cut my roses back. Hmm. And sometime around August, I even stop deadheading the roses so that I can get good hip production on them. Mm. But I don't grow the tea roses or the, you know, none of the hybrid. I grow the shrub roses and rugosa landscape mm-hmm. kind of roses. But they make good rose hips, and that's a nice thing to leave on during the winter. And I find that the roses are very cold hardy, and sometimes I have roses at Thanksgiving, which is really interesting.
there is no normal weather anymore, is there?
No, and hydrangeas. I don't cut the hydrangeas back. I don't cut any of the hydrangeas back, or butterfly bushes, or Caryopteryx. I also have a vitex in my yard, which is a blue chase tree. And that is another, what it would be considered a dieback shrub, much like butterfly bush, the buddleia or the Caryopteryx. Mm-hmm. And I don't cut back any of those dieback shrubs. I wait until spring, and I wait until they start to show me some growth. And then I look to see where their new growth is coming, and I cut them back to there. But a lot of those, if you cut them back in the fall or you cut them back too soon, you may end up with more winter damage, and in some cases, they won't come back mm-hmm. at all. So,
well, we have plenty of callers lined up. Patty Nagai is our guest talking about fall gardening, and Rick in Madison is up next. Hi, Rick.
Hi, appreciate your show.
Thanks.
My question is, I have a garden that is mainly clay.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering if there's something I could add to the soil or what I should add to the soil or if I should just say forget it and do a raised bed.
Well, you could
some way of saving this.
Well, you could do raised beds, but you can also garden in clay soil without a doubt. And clay gets a bad name. Clay is not evil. Clay is a fabulous soil type. There are some advantages to clay that you might not have realized. So clay is really good at holding nutrients. It usually is a little richer in nutrients than sand, for example. So clay is easily amendable, and you can certainly garden in it. It also holds moisture, as you well know, I'm sure, that it holds moisture really well. So you need to look at that as a plus rather than as a negative. The best thing that you can do for clay soil is add compost. And this may seem counterintuitive, but compost, a good rich organic matter added to clay soil, gives you the best of all worlds, because it will improve your drainage and it will also increase your microbial activity in the soil, which will make those nutrients a lot more available to your plants. So in some respects, and people who garden in sand may disagree with me, I happen to have clay soil also, though, so I'm trying to make the most of it and only speak highly of it. In some respects, clay soil is easier to garden in than sandy soil. And during times of drought, I really appreciate my heavier soil because I don't have to water as frequently as those who are gardening on sandy soil. But compost, or another source of rich organic matter, compost is, we like to use compost because it can be locally sourced, and it's a great way to renew your soil using locally produced plant materials. Compost can be used to amend both sandy and clay soils, and it provides different things for each soil. But the best thing it does is help to improve the microbial activity, which enhances all of that nutrient use. So it's good. And you can't add too much. So if you can find a good local compost facility that has clean, well-produced, kind of certified compost that doesn't smell or have weird things in it, you want it to look like good, rich earth. You can start incorporating that into your garden right now. You can put it on as a mulch and incorporate it next spring. You can just use it as a mulch and let it work its way into the soil slowly over time.
Okay.
You can't add too much.
Should I add sand?
No. Sand is not a good amendment for clay soil. If you think about the production of bricks, you realize that that's what bricks are made out of, and if you
don't want to be planting in bricks.
No. And you know, the thing is, for sand, if you were going to be planting in a container, for example, and you wanted to add sand to improve the porosity of the soil, what the recommended rate for sand to improve drainage is 50%.
Wow.
50% by volume. So think about how much sand you would have to add to your garden to do what you want it to do.
And that sand, as you said, Patty, doesn't have any nutrients in it. So you're actually making your soil poorer in some ways.
Right. So it seems like sand would be a great addition to help drainage, but in actuality, it is the worst thing you can add to clay soil. So organic matter, you need to add organic matter. And organic matter will improve your drainage.
All right. Thanks for that call, Rick. And Judith in Brookfield is next. Hi, Judith.
Hi. I planted this new clematis, Sweet Summer Love, and the picture is so gorgeous, but I'm not I have it mulched with cocoa beans, and there's nothing else around it that would worry it, and it's still the same height as when I got it. There were some new green leaves formed lately, but I don't have to worry about this to winterize, so I'm wondering, why isn't it, you know, growing now?
Did you just plant it this
spring?
Spring? Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, you know what? You don't worry about it over the winter. You make sure that you keep it watered until the ground freezes. And next spring, it will amaze you and it will grow better and perhaps it will even bloom. But it could have just been a really small plant. And sometimes they take 2 to 3 years before they get well established and really perform nicely.
I actually had to wait for it to quit growing before they would send it to me.
Oh.
So it's still about 12 inches.
Okay. Well, it will probably do much better next year. Don't give up on it.
So it's not the lack of sun all day. Yeah. There's sun in the morning.
It may not be getting enough sun. They do like a full day of sun. So if it's not getting at least 6 hours of sunlight a day, that could be part of the problem.
Like 10 to 3 for sure.
Oh, that's pretty decent sun. So I think you just need to wait a year and let it grow.
Well, and I know that sweet autumn clematis is one of Laura Jell's favorites.
Oh, but this one's sweet summer.
Oh.
She said it was
sweet
a new
summer.
Cultivar.
Okay.
So it's a little bit different from the sweet autumn.
But does it still have that really great foliage color and interest in the garden?
I don't know. We'll have to look it
up. Well, we'll have to ask. Judith, will you send us a photo of it when it's in full bloom?
Oh, I'd glad to.
All right. Thank you.
It's a combination of purple and cranberry.
Oh,
wow.
Yeah.
Nice.
That sounds lovely. Well, we'll look for a picture of that. Thanks for that call, Judith. And thank you to Patty Nagai. She is our guest today on Garden Talk. She's the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Racine County, always a font of information. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Gardening can be such a fun and even relaxing activity, but that doesn't mean that we don't need to put in some time and effort to get good results. And even then, sometimes things just don't thrive the way we'd like them to. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. So glad you could join us for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Patty Nagai is a UW Extension horticulture educator for Racine County, and she knows so much about successfully growing vegetables, flowers, fruit, and a whole lot more. Patty, thanks again for spending time with us today.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Well, we were just before the break, we were talking a little bit about mulching and composting. And there was a question from earlier. Karen from Edgerton emailed, can I put ashes from wood and leaves once they're cooled directly on my perennial garden? And will shredded leaves decompose fast enough to be a good compost?
Shredded leaves can compost for sure, but they probably will not compost if you're just adding them on top of the soil as a mulch.
They would start as mulch and then become compost.
No, I mean, they would eventually, because of course that's what happens in the forest. Eventually they become soil, but it takes a really long time. So for them to be truly composted, they would need to be turned and mixed with other green matter in order to get the right microorganisms and the right kind of processes developing to turn that into true organic matter. So we do use chip leaves as a mulch, and it's not a horrible thing if they get turned into the soil. You wouldn't want to turn in like a wood-based mulch, anything sawdust or wood chips or anything along those lines. And straw is very slow to decompose. So if you're using straw as a mulch, you wouldn't want to incorporate that into the soil either. You would want to scrape those off if you're not going to continue using them as a mulch, and put them in your compost, which would be really good.
And what about the question about using wood ash?
Wood ash is kind of a touchy subject, and it really depends on what kind of soil you have. So wood ash tends to be very alkaline and very high in potassium. If you're in a part of the state where you have very high potassium levels already, or you have a very high pH soil, wood ash is not a good amendment for your soil. And so it really depends on your soil type. Now, if you happen to be in a part of the state where potassium is depleted, perhaps you are more acidic, wood ash is often used in compost mixtures and mixed with other things, but not necessarily as a top dressing or as a mulching kind of an amendment to your garden area.
Great. Let's go back to the phones, and Patrick in Madison is up next. Hi, Patrick.
Hey, how's it going?
Doing well.
I've been helping out my parents. They live in northern Illinois. I've been helping them with some landscaping recently. And over the summer, I guess my stepdad, he kind of decided that he was tired of trying to maintain the backyard, like the lawn, as like a nice lawn. just mainly because nobody goes back there besides the dog, really. So over the summer, he kind of just let it go to see what would happen, and no surprise, it was just kind of a jungle of weeds. So I came in there at the end of the summer and tried to get in before all the weeds turned to seed, and we kind of mulched it all down and kind of tore up the soil with a rototiller. So now the plan is we're just going to try and transition it to more of like a native prairie with like wildflowers, the grasses and stuff. So my question is, I guess, just what would be the best method of doing that? And like, when would be the best time to throw down seeds, I guess?
Well, right now is a great time to be seeding native plants if you're going to go that route. But there are some additional steps that you might want to consider. And, you know, this is going to vary with a lot of people, different parts of the state, different types of soil, different, you know, whether it's a front yard or a backyard, and what's acceptable and what's not acceptable and how big it is. But just tilling is not going to be enough to kill the grass species that are already in the lawn and any perennial weeds that might have been in the lawn. And in fact, turning the soil, you're going to be turning up a huge array of weed seeds that may not have germinated previously because you had a nice thick lawn. So you probably have a lot of dandelion, thistle. You could have wood violets. You know, there are any number of lovely weeds that might be taking advantage of this newly tilled soil, and they're going to start coming up now. So there are some different methods for putting in a prairie to try and reduce those weed seeds ahead of time. Of course, you can use a product that is a total vegetation killer, something perhaps that contains glyphosate. You can, you know, to kill off all green material, but you would have to wait for some of those weed seeds to actually start to germinate. So generally what people do is they wait like 2 to 3 weeks under nice moist conditions, and then they might apply glyphosate, and then they come back and they clean it up again. They might till again. You know, they might do that process several times. Now, alternatively, if you don't want to use any type of synthetic chemical like glyphosate, there are some other organic weed control products that are simply acids. You know, they contain things like acetic acid or pelargonic acid. And those products are just vegetation burn products, so they won't kill the roots. They just kill the top growth. They tend to be kind of expensive, but they are organic, so, you know, that's an alternative as well. And then the other way, of course, is to just prepare it, you know, not use any chemicals at all. Clean up as much of the root matter and the vegetation that's currently there and prepare it like you would any other seed bed if you were going to be planting a vegetable garden or an annual bed of any kind, and get it prepared as much as possible. Buy a good quality native plant seed mix, which, you know, there's so many different ones to choose from. You need to do some research to really decide which species you want. Some of them come pre-mixed. You can have your own cultivars mixed. And it's generally a blend of grasses and forbs that go into a prairie. And you'll find a lot of different mixtures. But there should be one that was very suitable for your parents' lawn, I mean, their area in Illinois. And so we have a lot of good native seed producers in Wisconsin.
And especially if you're looking at prairie plants, they need a lot of sun in general.
They do need full sun, yes.
There so you are might some, want to pay attention to the right. light requirements.
There are some that will do okay in part shade that will show up in some of the native plant mixtures. And so that's another thing to consider for sure. You know, make sure that you're getting the right ones for your light as well. And then next spring, this is an ongoing thing. So it will take several years to establish a prairie, and you need to get really good at seedling identification. Mm-hmm. Because again, you know, you're going to have weed seeds germinating. They're not going to be in your seed mixtures. If you're buying your seed from a good quality native seed producer, they're going to be very clean and only native plants. However, you've got a seed bank already in that lawn that is going to be very voracious when spring comes.
There are critters bringing it in and the wind.
Yes,
and,
exactly. So you need to kind of keep walking through and pulling things that don't belong there. And you know, the thing that confuses a lot of people with the prairie plants is that the first year, and sometimes the first 2 years, you don't get any flowers. And so you're just looking at seedlings and green plants. And neighbors may think you just have an enormous weed patch going in the backyard.
If I'm remembering correctly, Neil DeBull from Prairie Nursery says that it's a good 4 to 5 years if you're starting from seed for a prairie planting to really
for
look like something.
For it to really look good.
Yeah.
By the third year, you will have some rewards. I mean, by the third year, you will start to see some really beautiful plants. But those first 2 years are kind of painful.
But it's a worthwhile project.
Absolutely.
Patrick.
Absolutely.
Thanks for your call. And let's go to Mike in Viroqua next. Hi, Mike.
Hi. How are you doing?
Doing well.
I was just calling. You asked what was growing well this year, and our Concord vines just took off like nobody's business this year. It was just the perfect weather for it. My dad went down and picked a bunch, and he tossed it to me from maybe 3 feet away, and when they landed in my hands, three of the grapes just burst.
Wow.
Wow. Explosive grapes.
Yeah, they're just packed with juice. We had just finished juicing. We got maybe 8 gallons, and
nice.
We gave half of them to our neighbor because they helped us pick them.
Wow.
That is fabulous. So, yeah, lots of water.
Unfortunately, we had to pick them early because we haven't had a frost, but we've lost them in previous years due to raccoons and deer.
Mm-hmm. That happens.
So I was wondering if there's anything short of just putting a cage of chicken wire over them or something like that. Is there any way to keep animals away?
You know, covering them is really the only way I know of. I can't think of any other thing. I mean, but it doesn't have to be chicken wire. You know, this might be a great use for floating row cover, which is a lot easier to handle than chicken wire and would also keep the birds out. Floating row cover is really easy to handle, and it's not that expensive, and it comes in huge sheets, and it comes very lightweight. It doesn't block the sun. It doesn't block, you know, the rainfall or anything like that, but it does keep out critters and insects, and so that might be an interesting option. It will look interesting, of course, to have your grapevines completely covered in this white cloth, but it's worth a shot. I was just telling Judith, I cover my raised beds in the winter with floating row cover just to keep the squirrels out, because otherwise they get in there and they bury all sorts of things I don't want in my garden. So I cover my raised beds completely with floating row cover for the entire winter, and it really helps to keep things cleaned up.
All right. Good luck.
Sounds great. Thanks. I'll check that out.
Good luck with that, Mike. And having exploding grapes and lots of them
it makes me hungry, actually. Yeah. I'm thinking about grape juice.
We'll be heading out to Viroqua after the show.
Yes, to pick some grapes.
Well, next is Jackie in Milwaukee. Hi, Jackie.
Hi. I benefit from everything every Friday. The one thing that I think that people don't know, they talk about clematis. They talk about the delicate little ones that grow up.
Mm-hmm.
I've been here for 54 years. Mm-hmm. On either side of my fence yard, I have sweet clematis.
Sweet autumn clematis, I bet.
Sweet autumn.
Yeah.
It grows. It's
fabulous.
It's wonderful. I hardly ever have to cut it down. And right now it's blossoming wonderful, wonderful
yes.
And it's something that if you want to keep your neighbors out, for whatever reason.
In a beautiful way.
So don't put all clematis in the same kind of a category.
No, and I didn't intend to do that. And I appreciate your comments.
No, I know you didn't.
Right. No. But, you know, there are, I think, over 400, 500 cultivars of clematis now. And, you know, and they're different types and different bloom times and colors, but some of the older, more traditional types of clematis are just wonderful to have in the garden. And there, I don't think there's anything that beats sweet autumn clematis because it is so resilient and it is very faithful in its growth and flowering. It's just beautiful.
Well, so Jackie, that your clematis has grown to 25 feet tall. How wide is it?
They grow like a vine along either side.
They're amazing.
Wherever you have planted
them.
Oh, okay.
Yes, and they will continue to grow, and they don't require a lot of maintenance. Some of the newer cultivars are a little bit pickier, and they take a little bit longer to get established, and, you know, they will die back, or they need to be pruned back, and then they regrow, and they're just not quite as vigorous as the Sweet Autumn Clematis. So, no, I agree. There is a wonderful place for Sweet Autumn Clematis in many people's yards, whether they have a fence or an arbor, whether or not they're trying to keep their neighbors out, or if they're just, you know, trying to provide a cover. It also grows, it really, you know, I've seen it used really effectively with grapevines over a very large arbor, and it provides shade in addition to all of the beautiful flowers and blends really nicely with the grape.
And what color is the fall foliage, Jackie?
White. Well, the flowers...
The flowers are white. What color is the foliage?
It's always green, but the flowers are tiny white.
Mm-hmm.
And you can smell them from across the yard.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I remember hearing that they had a really lovely aroma.
They have a lovely fragrance. Yes, it's true. Thank you.
Thanks, Jackie. And let's go next to Helen in Oshkosh. Hi, Helen.
Hi, my question is about raspberries, raspberry bushes, which were off to a great start this summer. They were just beginning to ripen, and they were large berries and everything, probably the best crop I ever had. And then my neighbor's lawn was sprayed by a commercial sprayer. And I later found out it had 2,4-D in the spray.
Ooh.
And many, almost all of the leaves on the raspberry plants turned yellow.
Mm-hmm.
And the immature fruits, which were just then developing,
mm-hmm.
dried up and fell off.
Mm, I'm sorry.
Now, some of those plants are beginning to look like they've revived. And they do have berries on them, but
mm-hmm.
I've been advised that those berries are not safe to eat. Would you want to give an opinion on that?
Well, I would not eat them. No, I wouldn't. But that doesn't mean that your plants are ruined forever. I would recommend this fall cutting them back and letting them regrow next year and seeing what the growth looks like. So 2,4-D gets inside the plants. And so once an application has been made, it will be in the plants for a while. Now, it may not be in a concentration that would be harmful, but I wouldn't take that chance. You know that it was there, and you've seen the effect of it on the other plants, and so it's just not worth the risk. Whether or not your plants will come out of it is just a wait and see. So herbicide damage to lots of plants is very common. We see it frequently on grapevines and tomatoes and even ornamental trees and shrubs in the lawns. And sometimes it's a drift issue. When 2,4-D is applied, it gets into the plant material, but while it's being sprayed, it will become somewhat volatile and it can drift into other areas of your yard. And if it is picked up by the foliage of any of those plants, you'll see the effects of it. And because it's a growth regulator, it can affect a lot of different things within the plant. So you can see really funky growth of the leaves or the canes. You can see issues with the fruit development. But as far as food safety goes, no. If you know that your plants have been sprayed with a chemical that is not approved for fruit crops, then no, you should definitely not eat them.
What do you think about the possibility that the soil has been saturated with 2,4-D and possibly these plants, if they revive next year,
mm-hmm.
They might again have 2,4-D in the fruit?
Well, 2,4-D, I am not a chemist, but 2,4-D is an herbicide that is taken up by the foliage. It does have a residual effect, but I don't know what the half-life of it is in the soil. I would suspect that by next year, there would be nothing left in the soil. But I don't know for certain. It's kind of a touchy subject because you're talking about an improper and technically illegal use of a thing. So, normally when we're applying 240, it's because we want to kill a plant.
Right.
And it's not used, in that manner. And I understand, I realize it's an accident. But by next year, it should be okay. I mean, we've seen plenty of places where herbicides are used to kill off weed species. And then the soil is turned and, any number of things might be planted in that soil. Because with most of those chemicals, they degrade pretty quickly once they're exposed to sunlight and soil and the microorganisms that are in the soil. The one that is very long lived in the soil is dicamba. So if, and a lot of times dicamba is mixed in with products that contain 2,4-D. So, that would be a good thing to look at too. Are you sure it was just 2,4-D? Dicamba can hang around in the soil for a very long time.
Thanks for that call, Helen, and sorry that your raspberries got affected. Speaking of raspberries, Terry asked on Facebook, would pine needles be okay to use for mulch on raspberries and for asparagus for the winter?
I love pine needles for mulch. I do. I wish I had a good source for pine needles. I would use them for mulch on everything. I like pine bark also.
Oh, well, there you go. And I know sometimes people are worried that they're particularly acidic.
Yeah. No, I wouldn't worry about that. And, I have very high pH soil. So I would welcome acidic materials into my yard. But no, you don't have to worry about pine needles greatly affecting the pH of your soil. And they make a really nice mulch. And they smell good and they look good.
Great. Well, let's take a quick call from Joe in Dousman. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I have a very small plot, and this year I managed to grow a really beautiful castor bean plant. Oh. I've never grown one before.
And they grow very quickly, and they're very large and beautiful, yes.
Yes, but the question is, I understand they're somewhat toxic, so
they are very toxic.
What's the best way to dispose of the foliage safely?
The foliage is not the issue. The issue is in the beans. And so you can compost the foliage, but the beans are incredibly toxic. So you probably don't want to put those in your compost, and you certainly don't want them to be accessible to any children especially. They are very deadly, very deadly.
Okay.
So handle them as if they, you would any toxic chemical.
Okay, but the foliage is safe to compost.
Yeah, you can compost the foliage. That's not a problem.
Great. Great question, Joe. And we had a couple comments on email and Facebook about, we were talking a lot about having to amend different soils and things like that. And one person, let me grab their name here, Matt on Facebook, suggested lasagna gardening, which is something talked about, which is creating really great soil, but all above the soil,
right.
Almost like a raised bed. And then David emailed and said he tried the straw bale gardening, which we talked about. And again,
I did that too this year.
So, yeah.
I grew squash in a straw bale and had very good production. I was surprised.
So sometimes if you don't have the best of conditions in your ground, you can do other things. Well, Patty, the time just flew. It's always a pleasure. Patty Nagai is a UW Extension horticulture educator for Racine County. Thanks so much for spending time with us.
Thank you.
And coming up on Monday, Larry will be back, and he'll be talking with Peter Green of Infostar.com about keeping our personal computers running well. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry. Thanks for listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.